You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And Tom Hartman here with you, and Rusty Humphries here with you. Hey, Rusty.
Hey, Tom. Thank you very much. And I want to welcome everybody to the Rusty Humphries Show and the Tom Hartman Show. We're doing something a little bit different today for the first half hour of both of our programs, right?
Yep. Yes, indeed. And for people who don't know, and you can explain on your end, I'll explain on my end. For my listeners and our viewers who don't know Rusty Humphries, Rusty's a conservative talk show host, has been doing radio for forever, just like I have.
Right.
And a good guy. Rusty and I got to know each other pretty well on a trip to Africa with Ellen Ratner.
Absolutely.
We went to South Sudan and on the Darfur border. And
it was one of those things where who would have thought that we would have really hit it off?
And we did.
And it's been 5-6 years. We still keep in touch.
Yep.
And I have a lot of respect for you. And I called your wife up a while ago and said, you know what, I'm coming to D.C. Tom and I should do a show together. She said, well, we'd love to have you as a guest. I said, no, I don't want to just be a guest. What I want to do is we're sitting in D.C. We're at your studio, which is right across the street from the Capitol. Those guys over there can't get anything done. They can't agree on what day it is, what kind of pizza toppings they want to have. And so I thought, well, maybe since you and I don't hate each other, maybe we can actually talk about the issues and go, okay, well, gosh, I can agree on that, or I can disagree on whatever, and try to find out, is there any common ground between the left and the right? Because right. If you look at Congress, there seems to be none.
Or perhaps even more interesting, I mean, you know, you and I have had some of these conversations, although a lot of the time that we were in Africa, we were not talking politics.
Right.
We were
by the way, speaking of Africa, it is as hot in this studio as it is in Africa. I'm guessing this is what happens with the non-commercial stuff. They don't give you air conditioning. Sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
They haven't turned the AC on in our building yet. So
saying in Africa, we talked about some of these things.
I think it's because the Heritage Foundation owns our building.
Yes, let's steam out Hartman. Let's take him down.
I'm not kidding. In any case, I think that there's some interesting. First of all, just an update. Everybody, you know, everybody listening to the news wants to know what's going on in Boston. The latest that we have is that apparently these were pressure cookers, these two devices that were packed with shrapnel, with ball bearings and things, and nobody has claimed credit. There's two, I think, probably significant things. One, this is Patriots Day, and three. Patriots Day. Now, Patriots Day was a different day of the week. It was the 19th or the 20th back when Tim McVeigh did his thing, but it was also Patriots Day.
Okay.
And that, courtesy of Ellen Ratner this morning, she came in and told me that. Secondly, the Boston Marathon, people from over 100 countries participating, so it's an international event. And third, it was tax day.
Okay, are you leading towards, because I saw this
I'm
on
not
the
leading
Daily
toward
Cause.
Anywhere.
Okay, because on the Daily Cause I saw today, they were hinting that this is a right-wing extremist kind of thing going on. And being a right-winger, and I don't believe I'm an extremist in any way, I don't see it at that at all.
Yeah.
I mean, it may be Patriots Day. What I do say, I've studied terrorists. I've actually, Tom, we didn't really talk about this before. I've actually met with terrorists. I've had guns in my back a couple of times. They've threatened to cut off my head. I mean, I've been in deep with terrorists. I've been to Guantanamo 3 times. So I understand the thinking there. And what they're looking for is a big splash. They're looking for a lot of people. The bombs weren't that big. I mean, they're big, they're horrible, but some of the telltale signs of the nails and the ball bearings. You know, again, I'm not throwing any aspersions, but I'm having a hard time believing that it's right-wing extremists.
Yeah, I'm inclined to think that this is probably more like what happened. I was living in Atlanta when that, you know, Richard Jewell was the guy who was accused. He was actually not guilty, and I don't remember the name of the guy who ultimately was. He was he had also bombed a lesbian bar.
Right, he disappeared in the mountains or something.
Yeah, hid out in the mountains in South Carolina for a year or two. And you know, bottom line, if you were to call him political, I would call him crazy.
Yeah.
And so.
Just like the Unabomber. I can't, you know, I mean, he was caught with Al Gore's book in his hand when he was.
Yeah, but he was no lefty and he was no righty. He was a crazy guy.
Right.
So, and this is, these are, you know, 300 million people in a country, you're going to have some crazy people. So, no, I'm not going down any road yet. I think that we need to find out what's happening here. And although both of us have been observing, we had dinner last night, we were talking about this, observing the kind of weird freak show of people who are coming out and, you know, one guy saying, oh, let's kill all Muslims, and another guy saying, oh, it's got to be the right wingers, it's time to, you know, arrest the militia guys and all this. I don't want to get even close to that freak show. You know, my personal opinion.
Sure.
Let's wait and find out what's going to happen.
Well, I agree with that. We also have seen, though, a lot of celebration in the Middle East for this attack.
Have we?
We have. We've seen a number of places in the Palestinian area, some other places. That's not right. I mean, we have to...
I don't think celebrating the death of anybody anywhere is ever appropriate.
Of course. And so these are, again, we do need to see what they find out. I believe they will find the right person. You know, the conspiracy theories are going to start coming out pretty soon. That's about, you know, when that stuff happens. Well, they announced such and such at the first 10 minutes, and then it went away.
Right.
Okay, they always announce such and such in the first 10 minutes, and it goes away, because the news reports are always wrong at the beginning.
Right. Yeah, so we'll find out what's going on. It's the Tom Hartman Program and the Rusty Humphries Show.
Thank you.
Rusty Humphries with us. We're simulcasting both our programs. Our audiences are combined at the moment, and we'll be for the
first
30
minutes. That's
a lot of
people, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, I mean, I think my show is ranked as the sixth largest in the country. You're right up there, too.
I'm ninth, I think.
Okay, I mean, that's a lot of people. Plus, you've got the television audience and everything. Yeah. So there's a lot of people listening here. And again, the idea is... As two people who don't agree on everything, by the way, we went to dinner last night. We had pizza. I had the meat pizza. You had the vegan one. Very stereotypical. It was awesome. And by the way, the vegan buffet here at the Tom Hartman Show is fabulous. I enjoyed the tofu, fried tofu. It was great.
Actually, tofu right in there. My miso soup.
Yeah, I'm sorry you're not stereotypical or anything. And you came from Portland, Oregon. Anyway, so...
But you live in Oregon.
I don't anymore.
Oh, you don't?
Oh, no. I live in Joe Arpaio Town.
Oh, you moved to, when did you move to Arizona?
I moved to Phoenix Christmas time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, me and Joe Arpaio. The idea is just, you know, where can we agree and disagree?
So here we have 2 minutes until the break.
Uh-huh.
How do you think it's best that people who fundamentally disagree on politics and worldview should communicate with each other in a way to maintain a relationship and yet not betray their own truth?
I tell you, I think the biggest problem that we have in the world today, and you might think this is pretty offensive. When I was a kid, I remember they used to have joke books, white joke books, Irish joke books, blonde joke books, all these joke books, okay? People didn't take themselves too seriously. They could laugh at each other, laugh at one another. What I think the biggest issue right now is we can't have a conversation like you and I do and joke about things and lighten things up and come
so
in.
So you're concerned about political correctness.
Political correctness, I think, stops everything. Because all of a sudden you can throw out any race card, you can throw out any kind of a shield that protects you in your opinion from being called anything. And so let's get rid of that stuff and just talk as people and say, okay, Tom, listen, here's what I think, blah, blah, blah. And and I think by not taking ourselves so seriously, I think we get a lot more done.
I don't disagree with that in general principle. I mean, we can, and I don't want to debate that.
Go ahead, debate it.
But we just have a minute to the break. But I'm curious what, in your mind, the biggest issue facing America is that we've had 32 years of no growth in wages in the United States. The middle class is dying. Mm-hmm. What, in your opinion, is the biggest issue facing America?
I'm concerned about the illegal immigration thing. Of course, that's in Congress right now. And I think that has a lot to do with the lack of growth. For example, when I was a kid, I could get a paper out. I worked in a movie theater as when I was younger. Most of those entry-level positions are being taken by illegal immigrants.
Right.
Every single one of them? No, of course not. But it's harder for younger people to get these entry-level positions because folks are...
But when you and I were kids, if an employer hired somebody who was not a citizen, they could go to jail. Doesn't happen anymore.
I agree. Lock them up. Absolutely. Make it so that folks...
Perp walks for rich white guys.
Sure. We can talk about that. Absolutely.
We just agreed on something.
All right. There we go.
Okay. We solved the immigration problem. We'll come up with another one in a minute. Rusty Humphries Show, the Tom Hartman Program. The first half hour here today being simulcast. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman, Rusty Humphries, right here. Stick around. 16 minutes past the hour. back. Tom Hartman here with you. Rusty Humphreys with you. You are listening to The Rusty Humphreys Show and The Tom Hartman Show.
Hello. Thanks for being here. We appreciate it. Millions Indeed. Of people listening right now. Indeed. And maybe we're going to change some minds and hearts today.
Maybe. You were saying, we were talking just a moment ago.
In the non-commercial section.
In the break, yeah.
You commercial people, buy all those products that you just heard on both our shows. Buy them all. Every
please.
Single one of them,
yes,
please.
Yes. And tell them you like both shows. You were talking about how, and we were talking about how nowadays it seems that if the president proposes it, the Republicans won't go along with it. If
right.
George Bush had proposed it, the Democrats wouldn't have gone along with it. You know, I pointed out Harry Truman had that problem. Mm-hmm. He ran against that, and I think America voted and said enough of this already. In fact, I think the history of the Eisenhower administration is one of great bipartisanship.
Because, and well, you had the
moderation.
Right, yeah, right. Well, you had, 20 years of FDR and the Democrat policies and the New Deal policies and the increase in big government and Republicans trying to push back. And so, yeah, under Eisenhower, it was like people finally, whew, geez, enough of that. Let's just kind of
let's build a country. Let's build our country back.
Maybe we can start doing that if more guys like you and I talk.
Maybe we should occupy, maybe we should invade and occupy a country and, like, build their schools and roads, and that country could be America. Okay. So anyhow, you were telling a story about Harry Reid.
Well, yeah, Harry Reid, I used to live in Reno, and Harry Reid used to come on my show all the time. Mm-hmm. We didn't agree on anything, but actually we had nice conversations. He would come to my house. I had dinner with him. We're working on having him on my program to talk like this. He's changing the way where he's not doing those kind of things anymore. He's not talking to the people. All congressmen seem to, even senators, especially senators, are insulating themselves. Mm-hmm. And I don't see how that's good for anybody.
Right. Yeah, I don't disagree with you. We've got a couple of bomber comments here on the line, but we'll take those. I don't disagree with you. However, the night that Obama was sworn in, mm-hmm. there was the meeting the Robert Draper immortalized in his book, They Speak Not of the Ill We Do or whatever, that meeting at the Caucus Room restaurant just a few blocks from here,
right.
where 19 Republicans, members of the Senate and the House, got together along with Newt Gingrich and Frank Luntz and swore basically a blood oath to block anything Obama did for the next 4 years to try to destroy his presidency.
I don't think it's a personal thing. What my concern is, and I believe their concern was too, that he was and has tried to take the country too far to the left.
What does
things
that mean?
Things like Obamacare, which is fundamentally going to change our health care system. I don't know about you. I tried buying insurance at the beginning of the year. It was next to impossible. I had a really, 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 really hard time.
But and you realize we're in about the only developed country. I think we are in the only developed country in the world where the phrase having to buy insurance even exists.
It's not working in those other places. And, Tom, you want to talk to a guy that understands what it's like? You know, my wife passed away after being sick for 8 years and in the hospital every 2 weeks for 2 weeks. Believe me, I understand the cost of health care, okay?
Yeah,
believe
sure.
me, I get it. But I don't believe that you should be paying for my health care or he should be paying for my health care. And my concern is, it's not your responsibility.
But aren't we all members of this country? Aren't
sure,
we, aren't
it,
we family?
All
it,
that
ultimately?
Sounds great. It does. It sounds great if we just put
no,
our
not,
money
I'm
together.
I'm not talking about I'm going to buy your car.
Right. No,
I'm not
but
talking
see,
about you're going to buy my clothes.
It just doesn't
I'm
work.
Talking about health care.
It sounds great. It just doesn't work. I wish it did. I really do. There's things, the idea of socialism, where we put our money together and we don't have to pay for food. We just kind of all work together as one.
That's really communism, not socialism.
Communism, socialism, whatever ism you want to call it.
Yeah.
You know, you've spent time in Israel. I've spent time in Israel.
Sure.
The kibbutz system, you know, it sounds great.
Well,
even
when you have 200 or 300 people, it works.
Sure.
But when you try to do
but
that
even
with
there,
5 or 10,000
right,
people,
even
it
there,
doesn't
they're
work.
Having a lot of problems.
Sure. And you know, the Soviet Union, I think, is a great demonstration of, mm-hmm. of how it doesn't work with large numbers of people. But I'm not suggesting that. I'm all in favor of private means of production.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things that I think are the commons. I think that, you know, our fire departments, our police departments, our schools, our health care. I think these are things that we should be providing mm-hmm. collectively to each other.
There's some collective stuff there, but we look at the education's a great example mm-hmm. where we're having so much difficulty. And if you've got...
But we weren't 30 years ago.
Weren't we?
30 years ago, being a teacher was one of the lowest turnover professions that required a college degree.
Okay.
Today, it is officially the highest turnover profession that requires a college degree.
And what has changed? Is it the kids? Is it the parents? Is it the pay?
It's going to sound very partisan, but I think it's people like Scott Walker trashing teachers and cutting their pay.
Well, you know, we keep hearing that they don't make any money. You know, I hear, well, they're only making, you know, $30,000 plus benefits the first year. Tom, I've been a radio. $30,000 in my first year out of college? Oh, my God, I couldn't imagine it. My first job out of college, I don't know about you, it was $10 an hour, maybe. You know, I was pulling down $12,000 a year. Yeah, I went to college, too, and it takes a long time to build that stuff up. So, again, I'm not putting down teachers, but I also know that the first chance I got my kids in a private school. And I think the idea of – I think where teachers and schools have a problem is they fight against the idea of competition. I don't see why that's –
Yeah.
Something that's a problem.
Well, and this is, I guess we'll just have
now,
to
Now, is that one
disagree.
You'll disagree with?
Yeah, I would. I would, because I don't think that teachers competing with each other helps anybody. I think a teacher needs to be, and when you and I were kids, I don't think our teachers were competing with anybody. They were working to educate kids.
Right.
And kids got educated.
But you get a choice. For example, I just moved to Arizona, and there's a lot of charter schools. I had no idea how many charter schools they have in Arizona. And I went to one and had my oldest daughter, and we talked to the principal. He says, listen, if you don't do well, I lose my job. Mm-hmm. So we really work hard to make sure that our kids do great because my school is owned by a corporation. And so it was a very interesting.
Public teachers can lose their jobs if they don't do well, too.
This
whole thing of you know, the teachers union is some big, you know, gorilla that's preventing, you know, maybe in some of the more obscure school districts in New York City. I mean, there are some places where there's more than a grain of truth.
Right.
But I think broadly speaking. Anyhow.
Are we done? Are you going to kick me out? Or do you want to? I'll keep going if you want to go. If you want me to go, I'll go. What do you want to do?
You want to stick around for the rest of the hour?
Sure, we can do the rest of the hour.
Okay, cool. It's the Tom Hartman
Look at
show.
The producers going, oh, geez, they screwed up the show. No. it's the Rusty Humphrey Show with Tom Hartman.
And the Tom Hartman Show with Rusty Humphreys.
There we go.
And we'll be back. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Talk to Rusty.com and TomHartman.com. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Rusty Humphreys on the line with us. It's the Rusty Humphreys Show as well as the Tom Hartman Show.
Thank you for having me here, Tom. I appreciate it.
And thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
And thank you for having me on your show.
We're having a great time, and I appreciate you guys doing this, except if you would, again, turn off the heater.
Yeah.
Talk to the Heritage Foundation.
Man. You got to talk to them.
It's 180 degrees in here.
Barry, the news is kind of trickling in about what's happening in Boston. Barry Nolan is with us. He was reporting for us yesterday. He's former newscaster at WBZ-TV in Boston, a professor of journalism at Boston University. NoWayButOne.com is his website. Barry, welcome back.
Good to talk to you again, Tom. No way out but one.
No way out but one. Okay. Okay. So Barry, what's the latest?
The most moving stories that are coming out today, the investigation is not moving forward very much, but the stories of the way people behaved at their finest in the moments after the explosion. It's something that I've seen when I covered the Oklahoma City bombing, covered the 9/11 events that night. People are, on a day when humanity is shown to be at its most savage, humans are shown to be at their most angel-like. People immediately began to run yesterday. We saw that on the TV. But now the stories are coming out about the way people from a couch in South Boston to 12 beds at a frat in MIT, people are offering up their homes to people that don't have a place to stay because hotels that were in the frozen zone inside the yellow tape have been shut down and people sent away. There wasn't enough airplane capacity to get everybody home immediately that didn't have a place to stay. Even people are putting out things on Facebook to take in people's pets. There are first responders and doctors and professionals that are working overtime to take care of this mass casualty event. And people put out, we'll take your pets in. Massachusetts General Hospital had to put up a note and saying, thank you very much for all the people that came in and donated blood, but we have more than we can use right now. Put a date on your calendar. Come in a week or two when we need it again.
Wow.
One of the things you see in an event like this is the biggest shortage is opportunities to help.
Yeah. Yeah, so we're in a very real way seeing the very best of people. Barry, can we catch up at the top of the hour and get into this in more detail? I've got Rusty here in the studio with me. I want to get back to that conversation. But bottom line, your report to us with regard to details, other than that now the New York Times is reporting these were pressure cookers filled with explosives and
what we're hearing now is at least one of them was a pressure cooker.
Okay.
That had shrapnel and ball bearings and nails put in it just to damage human flesh.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, Barry, we'll check back in with you in 20 minutes or so, 25 minutes?
That's fine.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Barry Nolan, nowayoutbutone.com is his website, and we will be back with former newscaster with WBZ, Barry Nolan.
You know, Tom, I, Rusty Humphries. Believe it or not, looking at me on television, you couldn't imagine this, but I'm actually a marathon runner. I've run 20 half marathons, 5 full marathons. I did 4 marathons in 54 days. I'm a part of the Marathon Maniacs, which is a crazy marathon group. The running community is a real special one. It is one where they are competitive more with themselves than with everybody else. It's you're competitive with the clock.
Right.
And so it's not surprising to me that community is really rallied around that area. Because Americans in general, when something bad happens, we rally together.
In my mind, really the big story of 9/11 was the people who ran into the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, obviously there were people running away too, but
right.
it's like this is something that, and I don't think this is just unique about America. I mean, we can do a certain amount of chest thumping here. I think this is human nature. I think, you know, as human beings, we're wired to care for each other during mm-hmm. particularly during times of crisis.
Sure,
it's the best of us. It's really the best of us. Let's take a couple calls here.
All right, absolutely. Let's go.
Kirk in Bothell, Washington, listening on 91.3 FM KBCS. Kirk, you are on the air with Tom and Rusty.
KBCS.
Yeah.
I worked it. That's from, that was the Bellevue Community College
and
Station, right?
Is.
Okay. That's where the second job. I worked at KJR in Seattle, and I went to college, community college at KBCS.
Oh, there you go. You're on the air. Again.
Oh, God. Okay. It was a jazz station back when I worked there. What's okay. going on?
So, what's up, Kirk?
How many years ago was that, Rusty?
That would have been about 83. Man, I'm getting old. 84, 83.
Okay. Well,
you're still a young guy.
The station was in the basement of a daycare still, right?
It was in a house. Yeah, in the basement of a house.
Yep. I was there for a while, too, so I know it well.
So, Kirk, what's on your mind?
I know where Tom's at on the answer to the question I'm going to ask, but I really want to know where you're at, because I've heard you discuss in the last hour that political correctness is a stumbling block to getting political resolutions
yes.
to a lot of the issues of our day, but... I think that Tom's of the position, I certainly am, that money in politics is the gigantic gorilla in the room. And then until that's taken out of the room, nothing's going to happen. I heard Jim Wallace, who founded Sojourners Magazine, speaking really eloquently. He's in Seattle this morning about how all of his efforts for lobbying are basically for naught until money is out of politics. He's not giving up hope. He's going to keep pushing, but...
I guess my question for you is, what part of money in politics is bad? Is super PACs bad? So I want to give money to a Tea Party group, for example. That's bad. Is it corporations? What is it you don't like?
Well, I'm asking you where you're at on it.
I mean, for example, if you're asking me, do I think that elections should be free and paid for by the people? No. That we should give up free broadcast time to politicians? Hell no. And I know they'd love that. Politicians would love that. All right now, it's already they have to get the lowest.
Do you think rate? We were talking before we went on the air. This building that we're in right here, we're two blocks from the Dirksen Building and the Hart Building, and there's a bunch of members of the House and Senate that I run into in the elevator every day who come over here to spend 2, 3, 4, 5 hours a day on the phone begging for money.
Mm-hmm.
They do that now officially. This year, officially, now members of Congress spend more time on the phone asking for money than they do with their staffs talking about legislation. Right. Isn't there something fundamentally wrong with that, Rusty?
Sure, absolutely. But how do you fix it? I mean, we don't fix it by having radio stations and television stations give them free advertising.
How would you fix it?
I don't know. I know. I don't have a problem with super PACs. I know a lot of people do, especially on your side. I don't have a problem with people getting together and donating money. The evil Koch brothers, you're on the right. You've probably gotten
evil
a check
George
from
George Soros. I mean, you
must get money from the Koch brothers. No, but if they would like to send me a check, it's Rusty at talk2rusty.com. I'm all for it.
If you're listening, Charles,
please go ahead. Donate the money. I appreciate it. But I've dealt with the Americans for Prosperity before. These aren't evil people. These are people that just.
Well, I'm not suggesting that they are, and I don't think that Kirk was.
Other people have. I've seen documentaries and stuff.
How can we have a democracy where the average person? I mean, this is the whole idea of America: is that the average person can run themselves. I mean, this was
the problem. Is we have Congress writing these laws, and they're not going to write the laws to make it better. They're going to write the laws to make sure it's harder to get new people in. You know, I'm no.
But
fan.
that's a somewhat different issue, and we can talk about term limits. I think elections are term limits, but how can you have a functioning democracy when it's for sale?
I don't know that it's for sale. There's a lot of really rich guys that haven't won. Also, we're a constitutional republic, not a democracy. I think there's a difference there.
But how can you have a functioning republic when, if not the legislators are for sale? Yes, there's some rich guys who have lost, and Meg Whitman, I think, is a great example. Mm-hmm. In fact, I would say she lost in part because she was perceived as trying to buy an election and arrogantly trying to buy an election.
Mitt Romney has had a lot of money.
Sure, and I think it hurt him. But all that said, for example, this Monsanto rider that just got slipped into now it's illegal to sue Monsanto.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you can be sued. I can be sued.
Right.
Any other company in America can be sued.
That shouldn't happen. Right. That's not right.
It shouldn't have. It was slipped in by what's his name?
Who is it? I want the name.
Yeah.
I'm coming after him. Republican or Democrat, I don't care. Green Party.
Who
commie.
Was it say? Oh yeah, it was Roy Blunt. And he's the largest.
Like
he's the largest recipient of Monsanto money in Congress.
Okay, well, I'll talk to Roy Blunt about that.
Yeah,
I will.
Why would you do that? I mean, they invested $65,000 in him, and they're going to make millions. I mean,
for example, the Obama administration's had a bad habit of doing that with green energy companies.
With the banks, with health
Cylindra,
insurance.
Right, all those.
I think we
both agree on that. So,
so
I agree.
What
how
do we
get the
do
money?
About it?
I don't know that. I don't know how you fix
you
that.
You know, in the UK, they say that you can only spend, they do it by regulating the politicians.
Mm-hmm.
You can only spend $100,000 or £100,000 on a campaign. And that's why their campaigns are only 4 weeks long.
Okay.
Because that's about how fast you burn through the money.
Right.
But I think that our Supreme Court would say that violates the First Amendment.
Sure, and I agree with that. I do believe that money is speech, and that's how you get on television, that's how you get on radio, and by making
money's not speech; it's property.
Well, no, but you're not going to get on your radio stations or my radio stations unless you buy the advertising.
Well,
you can call in. You're going to get one or two minutes unless you're boring, and then I hang up on
but,
you.
But if enough people make enough noise, someplace,
right, but
we'll get
a
covered.
Guy running for office can't call enough talk shows to get an office.
Yeah, that's a lousy way to run for office.
Yeah.
I agree with you. So I guess neither one of us has a solution yet. Or at least
give us 10 minutes, we'll fix it.
Okay, all right. Rusty, it's the Rusty Humphrey Show, the Tom Hartman Program, and it's 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Talk to Rusty.
Talk to the number 2, talktorusty.com, and Facebook Talk to Rusty.
There you go. And Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit tomhartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls and our thoughts after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Rusty Humphreys with you.
Yes, here on the Rusty Humphreys and the Tom Hartman Show.
Indeed. Shows.
Shows. We spend a lot of time coming up with the names of these programs. And
really tough stuff to figure out.
People always say, how'd you come up with the name of your show? Well, I don't know. My mom had something to do with it.
Okay. Barney has a question. Barney in Seattle. Hey, Barney.
How are you doing?
What part of Seattle are you in, Barney?
I'm right dead smack in the center of the universe, Fremont.
Okay, great. I know that area. I grew up in the Des Moines area, which is halfway between Seattle and Tacoma. Anyway, what's your question?
You too. Very beautiful.
Yes.
I just want to know, I was just asking, do you remember this little ditty? I think it goes, Pledge Allegiance to the Flag and the Democracy to which it stands.
No.
To the Republic for which it stands.
Oh, Republic. You guys just brought that up a minute ago.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, have you ever heard the word sovereignty?
Yeah.
It seems to me that when you start talking about above the law, when we established this Constitution, we declared it into being, and where did we get that authority?
Well, I think that, you know, if you want to go back to the history of the Enlightenment, you could say that this started, you know, with Leviathan, you know, Thomas Hobbes arguing that maybe people could govern themselves.
Sure.
And then John Locke in 1774 with the Second Treatise on Government saying that life, liberty, and property. And then, you know, a century later, Thomas Jefferson. But
thanks for bringing us down. I appreciate it. We were on a good flow there, and all of a sudden, there's a word for that. It's called bad radio. Sorry.
Okay,
next.
Todd and Annie. Anoka, Minnesota. Todd, listening on AM 950. Hey, Todd, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Rusty, I appreciate your being there. It really is an interesting conversation.
Thank you.
I did take issue with something you said a while back.
Uh-oh.
When Tom asked you about what you thought the most pressing issues were, and you mentioned political correctness.
Yes.
The example you used was you said when you were younger there were the joke books out that made fun of the Irish and the Polish and how everyone could laugh at them, and that's not politically correct anymore. And I'm probably even older than you, but I do remember those books. I think the big difference, though, is that the Polish and the Irish were completely assimilated into American culture at that time. So you could make jokes of those people, but there were tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, that were totally successful in the nation and could laugh at themselves. But at the same time, when jokes were being made of people of other races, who at that same time had signs they had to look at that said, no blacks allowed or whites only.
Well, they certainly didn't have those signs when I was a kid. And I'm a short, fat, white guy, so I'm sure there's short, fat, white guy joke books, or there should be. The problem is that we allow people to be victims. And what I'm saying is you're not a victim. I'm not a victim. Look, there are people that have been gone through some horrible things in their lives. And you know what? The people who were part of the bombing in Boston, they're victims.
I think Todd's point was that making jokes about people when they are powerless can be cruel. When they are
powerless
when
anymore.
They are when well the
you know I mean
I would
are
they
poor and down at yes
you know,
and again am I saying
for example,
that we should be going
gay
out
teenagers
there doing,
have the highest suicide rate in
okay,
the United
am
States.
I saying that am I saying that we should be out there telling gay teenager jokes? That's not what I'm saying. What
okay
I'm saying
then you
is,
are politically correct.
No, what I'm saying is that we need to be able to lighten up as Americans. We need to be able to not take ourselves so seriously. You're talking about the suicide,
sure,
right, with gay teenagers. You know what? They need to stop taking themselves so seriously. I know it's hard. We all had rough lives. I had an alcoholic stepfather. My father was killed in Vietnam. My wife died a few years ago. I can sit around and be a victim, but I'm not.
Right.
And so if we tell people, yeah, you're a victim, you're right. They'll believe it.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. Paul in Woodinville. I'm sorry, Paul. Mark in Northbrook, Illinois, listening on WCPT, our Chicago blowtorch.
All right.
So what's up?
Have you been to Mr. Beef in Chicago? That's an awesome place. You been to Mr. Beef in Chicago?
Absolutely.
Unbelievable place. Anyway, what's going on, brother?
Well, you were talking before about money in politics. And you got into whether or not that's a problem. And I might suggest that the issue with money in politics is that money is power, whether it's corporate or 1% power. And the Constitution is specifically designed to separate power and diffuse power, because those folks that were our founders knew about power from Europe and they wanted to avoid it. And the concentration of both money and power was a problem.
Well, I'll tell you one place that power and money is not working, and that is trying to get a Republican into Chicago. Good luck with that.
Yeah.
I don't care you got Koch brother money or whatever. That's a Democrat town. Yeah. They had a guy running for Jesse Jackson's seat. He was a black guy. I forget his name. He was on my show, although he had he had been in prison for 20 years. That's probably not a very good sign to try to get a job there as a congressman. But he got beat like
a rented mule.
It's
supposed to work the other way around, I think.
Well, he had reformed himself. He had a good story.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he got beat like there was no tomorrow.
Yeah.
And they put a lot of money behind him.
Jefferson wrote at some length on a number of occasions about how if wealth becomes so great that it can corrupt a political process, it should be subject to taxation. Hmm. In fact, he said geometric taxation. In other words, as the wealth goes up.
Now, that's the guy that spent himself in a bankruptcy, too.
It's true.
But he got a nice house, though. I've been there. It is a difficult situation. It's a difficult problem to fix.
Why but again, this nobillionaires.com website?
Huh?
Nobillionaires.com. You can have 999,999,000.
I don't want to have a maximum wage.
So how much is too much?
There is no such thing.
There's no such thing as too much.
No.
You don't think there is a point where wealth is so great that
it corrupts
our
republic. No, because it'll be $1 billion, and then once that gets done, it'll be $500 million. Once that gets in for a while, pretty soon it'll be $1 million. Then it'll go down to 100,000.
You know, I don't disagree with your slippery slope argument.
Mm-hmm.
I don't disagree with that. On the other hand,
we keep agreeing on stuff. Dang it!
On the other hand, there are ways around that, and that's like index things for inflation.
But again, they mess with the numbers.
Yeah.
You know, this government, and it's both Democrats and Republicans.
So the bottom line is, you just don't like the idea that of basically redistribution of wealth.
I want to make $2 billion.
Yeah, and you know, I probably most people would like to make $2 billion,
but
I would say if I made $2 billion, I have an obligation to give back a good chunk of that to the society that made it possible.
And where I choose to do so, not where your party chooses to give it away or my party chooses to give it away.
Why say where we all choose to do it, because that's our republic?
No, it should be my choice. It's my money.
Okay. All right. Well, there I think is the point of divide. Rusty Humphries, Tom Hartman. Thank you, Rusty.
Thank you, Tom Hartman. I appreciate you being here on the show.
Thank you for being on my show.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you all alone. It was nice to have Rusty in. I'll tell you a little more about Rusty and I. Well, just very, very quickly. Rusty and I have known each other for a lot of years, but not very well. And we went to South Sudan together to the border with Darfur to a little town called Gok Bachar. And slept on the ground 500 miles from the nearest electricity and the nearest paved road. As we watched thousands of refugees stream in from the slaughter that was going on 15 miles away, and we were, you know, doing what we could to get food and medicine to people. And, you know, he's a conservative talk show host, I'm a progressive talk show host, and we were both doing our shows by satellite radio to try and bring some publicity to what was going on. And so he was in town yesterday. We got together for dinner, and he said, hey, let's do a show together. So we did. So, and Barry Nolan, I so much appreciate you coming back on. Now Rusty has gone off to do the rest of his show, and we have a little elbow room to have a conversation about what's going on in Boston. Barry, you're still with us?
Yes, sir. Okay. And may I say, I think that's a great thing that you did, that the two of you sat down and just talked together. I think that's a great idea.
Well, that was our goal, was, you know, we disagree on just about everything political, but we really genuinely like each other. And, you know, how do we have more of these kind of conversations, or how do we initiate them, or whatever? So, but just for people who maybe didn't see you yesterday, Barry Nolan is a former newscaster at WBZ, professor of journalism at Boston University, and the website, the documentary, No Way Out But One, O-N-E.com. And so, Barry, you want to recap for us your experience yesterday in Boston, and what the state of knowledge is today, and then any of your pontifications, any of your thoughts on what all this means.
Yesterday you had the fairly typical and absolutely understandable rush of chaotic information, much of which turned out to be wrong. Yesterday there were lots of news reports that 2, 3, 5 other unexploded devices had been found and disarmed by the police. It turned out none of that was true. There were news reports that a Saudi national was someone of interest, who was a suspect, who was under arrest. That turned out to be untrue, though the police did go to his house in Revere today with his permission, and they left there carrying papers and duffel bags full of what you assume is going to be evidence. Local TV stations interviewed his roommate, and he said, "This is this guy. Come on, he's 20 years old. He's young." Said, "No, it wasn't him." This is the kind of thing that brings out the worst in a small number of people, and brings out the best in so many people. People just, in the wake of this, listen to the better angels of their nature, and they extended kindness and hospitality and warmth and compassion and help to perfect strangers. They opened their homes, they opened their wallets, they opened their veins and donated blood. But at the same time, you see here and there, it brings out the worst in people. People like the far, so far right, he can't take a taxi cab to where the far right begins. Alex Jones has on his website the idea that this is a false flag information coordinated and executed by the FBI in order to get a bigger budget for the TSA.
For the TSA. I figured it would be so that they could take away our guns or something.
Yes.
I mean, you know,
Well, it's part of the FBI plot to take away our pressure cooker.
Yeah, right. Right. There you go. It's an anti-pressure cooker. Why didn't I realize that? Oh, my God. Soon there will be a run on pressure cookers. Okay.
And then in Boston today, a flight that was going to go to Chicago and had left the gate returned to the gate. Because some people, apparently people that had participated in the marathon, became concerned that two men on the flight who weren't sitting next to each other were speaking Arabic, and they became concerned.
Oh,
so people that are different, people that are dark-skinned, people that seem Muslim, people that seem Arabic, become objects of suspicion here in Boston, remembering, of course, that this was one of the cities where two of the flights from 9/11 originated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things that the police are saying today, either one, I've heard various reports, one or two of the explosive devices was built around a pressure cooker. You can go on to the internet and see examples of pressure cookers blowing up when nobody intended for them to blow up. Right. And it's terrible.
It can be very messy.
Yeah. It's not something you want happening in your kitchen.
Yeah.
And apparently that is similar to some of the explosive devices that have been used in Pakistan and Afghanistan, but it's also the sort of thing that you can learn to build for yourself if you're demented by going on the internet.
Right. Right. So the bottom line is we're still no closer, at least we the public are no closer to having any information about who did this or why. All we know is a little bit more about the how.
It's worth remembering that the event that is closest in kind to this, the bombing at the Olympic Park, took 6 years to solve.
In Atlanta, And during that 6 years, that poor guy, Richard Jewell, everybody was accusing him of it, and it turned out he was a good guy.
They had the wrong guy for 6 years, and he was a pariah for 6 years.
Yeah.
And finally they solved it, and it was somebody that was an anti-abortion activist.
Right, who had also bombed a lesbian bar. But Eric Rudolph was his name, who's now in prison.
Eric Rudolph is still trying to be active. I got an email from a cameraman friend of mine about Eric Rudolph, who was finally captured after pretending to live in the woods for a long time.
Yeah.
And he's still trying to raise Cain from inside his prison cell.
Amazing. So it might just be another demented Eric Rudolph type. We just don't know.
One of the things they do say is that you hear a lot of reports that there has not been chatter that the intelligence community has picked up, either inside or outside the country. Remember back before the Oklahoma City bombing, which was somewhat, in some ways, similar in that it was a bombing in the center of the city that made no sense. There was a lot of chatter amongst the militia types that were very anti-government. There was a lot of talk about black helicopters. They were very angry about what had happened in the tragedy down at Waco.
Now, that was the two-year anniversary of Waco. And that was also a Patriots Day in Massachusetts, although it's although it wasn't on the 15th, it was on the 19th, but it was the same. Apparently, at that time, it was the day of the week or something like that, or maybe it still is.
One of the things back then, the people were so crazy back. We forget how crazy a large percentage of the American population has always been. Back in those days, when the militias were on the rise, there were a lot of people that believed that a plan for the UN and the commies to take over the U.S. government was spelled out in secret codes on the backs of cereal boxes.
Wow.
There's people that...
I read the Turner Diaries. Do you ever read the Turner Diaries?
I never did.
It's a rather poorly written novel, but it's basically about this guy who blows up the federal building in Oklahoma City, and it causes all the good white people to rise up and kill all the African Americans and Jews and government employees.
It ignites the race war they've been.
Yeah, nobody's left standing except white Protestants. I think they were killing the Catholics too. So it's amazing, but let's hope. Well, we'll find out. Barry Nolan, former newscaster WBZ, professor of journalism at Boston University, the website No Way Out But One, O-N-E, NoWayOutButOne.com. Barry, thank you for the report.
Thanks, Tom, and thanks for the good work you do every day.
Thank you so much. Good talking to you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. We'll be checking in with another resident of Boston right after the break. Stick around. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People of the United States of America. Taylor Hartz is on the line. Taylor is a journalism student at Boston University. We were just speaking with a professor of journalism, Barry Nolan at BU. And Taylor, I understand, first of all, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you for joining us. I understand you were there yesterday.
I was.
So as a journalist or a journalism student, how would you report this story? What was your experience and what do you know that we need to know?
My experience was very overwhelming in the first few moments there. As soon as I received a message hearing that there was a bomb in Copley, I immediately went straight down to Kenmore Square, where they had begun evacuating runners who had seen the news headlines on their phones and were starting to cry and become frantic, and they were escorting them out of the marathon route at that time.
Right.
At first, there was just a sense of shock for the entire city. People seemed very isolated in their first few moments. Everyone was glued to their cell phones, either checking news headlines or trying to contact family members, and there wasn't much cell phone service in those immediate hours following the attack. It was very overwhelming and very stressful for everyone involved, but emergency responders and police came promptly and were very successful in evacuating the runners and helping them reconnect with their family members.
Mm-hmm.
I think as a journalism student, this was a very educational experience for me. It was very difficult to detach myself from the events that were going on and not the sights that I was seeing and families crying as they were reuniting with their loved ones who they hadn't been in contact with sometimes for hours.
Right.
But it was very interesting to see how the emergency responders reacted so quickly and so effectively.
I'm curious, as a journalism student, you have, I'm guessing, correct me if I'm wrong, that at some point, either in the course of your training or just your imagination of the future that you may have as a journalist, that you have thought about or anticipated what it would be like to be in a high-intensity crisis situation and how you might respond. And if that's the case, I'm curious how the reality might have been different from that.
Absolutely. We're very well trained in that here at BU. Our professors always stress the fact that bad things are going to happen in the world, whether or not we are there to photograph it. And that was something that I heard in the back of my mind all day yesterday, that I really just had to detach myself from the situation. It wasn't until I got home around 8:30 p.m. last night that I really was able to sit down and let sit in the gravity of what had occurred and really allow myself to have an emotional response. I was really focused on getting those photos and being able to submit them on time to publications that were looking for images of what was going on down there.
Right. And I should let our viewers on television, on Free Speech TV, Dish Network, DirecTV, Comcast, whatever, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, know that the images that you're seeing on your TV screens are photos that you, Taylor Hartz, took. You're yesterday at the event, just to make sure that the credit is there, but also these are some pretty amazing pictures.
Great. Thank you so much. I very much appreciate that.
It's got to be a tough one separating yourself from what's going on around you to, hey, I've got some work to do here. I need to take these pictures.
Absolutely. It was very difficult, and there were times that I was walking on side streets separated from the Copley and Kenmore area, and I did choose to just put my cameras down and speak to people for a few minutes because I found a lot of runners who were alone, either sitting on the side of the road or standing there just looking completely shocked and lost. And I approached a few of the runners and asked them if they needed anything, if they needed access to a cell phone or water, if there was anything I could do to help. And I think that having chosen to do that really helped me balance handling this experience as both a human being and as a journalist.
Yeah. And Taylor Hartz, for our radio listeners who are not seeing these pictures right now, is there a website where they're aggregated? I mean, I'm pretty sure we have a link at tomhartman.com to a Flickr site where you have uploaded these. Do you know it offhand what it is? Or?
Yes, they're posted on flickr.com/TaylorHartz. That's H-A-R-T-Z, and they're in an album titled Boston Marathon Bombing, and they're also posted on the Boston University News Service website.
Okay, great. Great. So that all of our listeners can check it out, because you've done some really very was photojournalism your area of expert of interest and study, or just journalism in general?
Yes, I'm focusing on photojournalism.
Therefore, the quality of these photos, because they're as good as anything I've ever seen out of any news organization. It's a very, very good work. What's your sense yesterday? Yesterday, Barry was telling us that the city was in shock, the sense of shock. What is the sense of the city today?
It's very quiet in Boston today, something I noticed since I woke up to go to my first class this morning. There's kind of just a solemn emotion around, but I think that what the major news organizations have been reporting and what President Obama said in his speech today, that Americans will not be terrorized and that we take experiences like this as a sense to gather our community, is something that can really be proven in Boston today. I think that everyone is just communicating a little bit more and being a little bit kinder to one another. And all I've seen all day are postings for vigils and fundraising and charity communities developing to help the victims of this tragedy.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, it's Taylor Hartz, H-A-R-T-Z. Right.
Yeah.
On the Flickr. Is there a sense that the other shoe is going to drop, or is there a sense that this was a one-off?
I think that today there's more of a sense that this was a one-time occurrence.
Yeah.
I don't think that there's as much of a sense of fear here today as there was in the later hours last night. Boston University was basically on lockdown last night. Students were instructed to stay inside, and we were unsure if there was another bomb in the city. But I think that today everyone's feeling a little bit safer and impressed with how the emergency personnel handled the situation yesterday.
Great. Taylor Hartz, journalism student at Boston University. Taylor, thanks again for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And we have links to Taylor's work over at
TomHartman.com. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you will find links to Taylor's work, great photojournalism of the event yesterday, over at TomHartman.com. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Zully Ramirez is on the line with us. Zully Ramirez, a New England news reporter with Univision TV in Boston, covering the bombings. Univision TV's website is wunitv.com, if I have that right. Zully, welcome.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am well. How are you? What's the situation in Boston right now?
Well, Tom, right now, what I can tell you is that Boston right now it's really going through a big tragedy right now. Right now, what we know is that the area of downtown Boston, specifically the area of Copley Square where the Boston Marathon was taking place, it's closed. At least 12 blocks are closed right now. There's a lot of police presence there. What we know so far is that there are at least 170 people injured, 3 people dead. 2 of the victims have been identified. One is Adam Richter, and he was 8 years old, and Crystal Campbell, she was 29 years old, and they have they die during the explosion. The parents of Adam Richter, they're also hospitalized. We know that the mother has suffered a brain injury, and his sister has lost a leg. The father released a statement today, you know, saying, asking for privacy as, you know, they continue in, you know, with this process of release. What we know right now is that also authorities have found parts of the circuit board, as, you know, as part of the investigation. We don't know exactly the details about this, circuit board, but, we know that the FBI is offering about, a reward of $50,000 who might, have any information and might lead to a arrest. We expect to hear from the governor and the FBI in the next 30 minutes or so with an update with any information for this investigation. But so far, that's what we know, you know, at the moment.
Right. Zulie, you work with Univision.
Correct.
Have you noticed any difference in the coverage of Univision, of CBS, NBC, ABC, Fox, cable versus, or is this, or not?
Well, you know, we are pretty much aiming at the same thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we look for the victims, you know, we try to give a face to those victims, and like today, you know, I was looking forward to see if there are any Hispanics that were involved, and we found, you know, a family, an Ecuadorian family from Massachusetts that was actually there,
mm-hmm.
and his son, his son was injured. He's in stable condition, but I actually got to talk to the father, and the son is hospitalized right now in Tufts Medical Center in Boston. And he was actually describing the scene, you know, the chaotic scene, because he was actually where the bombs happened. Mm-hmm. And he also told us that he actually helped the dad of Adam Richter, the 8-year-old who died. And he actually described the scene as it was terrible. He didn't want to go in details of, you know, because he said it was really, really bad.
Yeah, yeah. It's difficult to even re-describe
some
things because you re-experience them, and that can just be quite overwhelming. Have you heard any stories? I mean, we heard the story about this plane at Boston that got pushed back to the gate because there were 2 men who were speaking Arabic and had dark skin. This is, in my opinion, the kind of the worst of our paranoias coming out.
Exactly.
I'm curious your thoughts if you or Univision have covered any other stories like that, or if on the other hand, what we're seeing is more of a sense of, hey, we're all in this together, we're all Americans together, and less of the, you know, rah-rah, chest-beating stuff that we saw immediately after 9/11.
Well, you know, Tom, unfortunately, like you said, this is part of the results of, you know, the paranoia that we're experiencing right now. And, you know, it's unfortunate. And us as Hispanics, you know, we have also gone through, you know, similar events, and it's very unfortunate. But as for now, we don't know any details about that. But again, what you're seeing it's just a result of this terrible tragedy.
Yeah. Okay. Zuly Ramirez, you're doing great work. New England News reporter with Univision TV in Boston covering the bombings, WUNITV.com, if I had that right. And
WUNITV.com.
Right.
Yeah.
And your Twitter is at Z Ramirez, R-A-M-I-R-E-02. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Cool.
Thank you so much.
Zuly, thanks so much for being with us. And it's much appreciated, the report and the insights and the perspectives that you had to share with us. Thank you. Wow, a lot going on. Really a lot going on. Noah in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Noah, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. It's good to be with you. It's been a few weeks since I called. the reason why I'm calling is because I kind of wish that Rusty Humphries were still around to hear this. He's the slippery slope argument. And when you said you don't disagree with the slippery slope argument, my head almost exploded.
No, I said there's a way to solve. I said I don't disagree with the idea of a slippery slope if you can see that you're going in a direction you don't want to go. But there's a way to solve that, and that's by there not being a slope. And that's why I said you simply inflation adjust things.
But his argument was clearly a slippery slope argument. And
sure.
It's one of my pet peeves that people get away with that on TV and especially in politics at the time, because it's a formal logical fallacy and nobody should be
arguably you could take any argument and turn it into a slippery slope argument. Is that your point?
Actually you can't. It's a very specific type of argument. It's a formal logical fallacy. And
please illuminate me. Give me an example.
Well, like you said, if you take taxes, you try to tax somebody at wealth over $1 billion, like your No Billionaires campaign.
You're right.
And then his argument was, well, if you start doing that, pretty soon it's going to be $3 million, then it's going to be $2 million, then it's going to be $1 million, all the way down to, you know, you could end at $50,000 or $25,000, then we have a communist country, and then blah blah blah.
Right.
That's fallacious reasoning. You can't infer any of that.
I don't want to channel Rusty Humphries here, but my guess would be that a conservative response to your deconstruction of that logic would be when the income tax was first put into place, it was 1% on income over $10,000, as I recall. And I'm talking about the very first income tax, the one that Abe Lincoln put into place to help fight the Civil War. And it was very, very small, and you know, over time it's rather grown, has it not?
This is very specific about inferring about the future
right.
That you cannot possibly know, and it happened to turn out that the top income bracket got up to 91% during Eisenhower's administration.
Yeah, I think it was a good thing. I'm in favor of that slippery slope, but I still don't understand. And maybe I'm just missing something here, and please forgive me, Noah, if I am, how just the concept of a slippery slope is in and of itself a logical fallacy. How is that?
Huh?
How is it not possible that doing something that seems like a reasonable good, if done to excess, cannot become a harm?
You can't infer that, though. That's false inference.
Why?
It's a logical fallacy. It's false reasoning.
Why?
A slippery slope is it's in any logic textbook out there. It's just because it's an inference by induction, and you can't say that taxing billionaires over $1 billion of wealth is going to lead to a communist country or a socialist country. It's just because it didn't happen.
Right.
When 91% tax rate under Eisenhower,
right.
It didn't happen.
Well, it did happen, and there were people like Daddy Koch who thought that Eisenhower should be impeached for it. I mean, certainly Earl Warren should be impeached.
What actually happened afterwards is that taxes went down to 28% under Reagan.
Right.
So
that
clearly shows those fallacious reasoning. And it's fallacious reasoning all the time. It's a formal logical fallacy, and it should be called out every time it's used.
Okay.
People shouldn't get away with it.
Okay. Okay. I'm I think I understand what you're saying, Noah, and I'm sure that whatever I'm missing, somebody's going to fill me in on. Noah, thank you for the call, and for watching us there in Madison, Wisconsin. It's fascinating doing a show where more often than not your listeners are smarter than you are. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And one of our listeners today is going to get a copy of Unequal Protection, How Corporations Became People and How You Can Fight Back, by me, autographed by me, sent to you by Stamps.com. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave in South Sudan and receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped. GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, of course, the Boston issue is front and center here at the White House. The president made a statement, and then they canceled the briefing. We do know that there were these two-liter pressure cookers, metal ball bearings, nails, and gunpowder in these bombs. And then they were seen some black duffel bags. It also looks like they may have found the board that detonated this, but that's all we know. There was also a briefing this afternoon by the physicians. Three people definitely dead, as many, and again, this is very up in the air because they're not releasing specific information, 25 to 30 people with one leg missing.
Oh, my.
But they have taken the critical list down from 17 to, I think, about 7. It may be 8. The doctors seemed a bit unsure.
Critical meaning they're still at risk of dying.
That's right. Now, also, it's interesting, Justin Duckham, who works with us, there was a report of the Penske truck being coming to the area saying he had medical supplies. Penske said that all of their trucks have been accounted for, but they also have not heard from the FBI. So that was a Justin investigation today on that. It looks like the FBI is taking the lead on this. So that is that's sort of where that is at in on that front. On some other issues, Senator McCain and Senator Schumer, as you know, today was going to be the big immigration rollout. It did not happen, but they came to the White House to brief the president. Then they did come and talk to the press. Unfortunately, I was on the air. It was just about 15 minutes ago on that front. Senator Kerry is going to testify tomorrow at the House Foreign Affairs Committee, this is going to be his first congressional testimony as Secretary of State, and he is going to be talking about the budget request. So that is going to be happening, as you know. They're under sequestration as well. Also, the Secretary of Defense, Hagel, is going to be going to Israel. This will be his first trip as Secretary of Defense. Now, something a little more interesting than going just to Israel, although for some people that may be pretty interesting, and there is this, and I hope I'm pronouncing it right, the CISPA program on cybersecurity and threats.
Mm-hmm.
So the White House said today that they may veto this. That they are concerned about civil liberties. Well, that is very, very good news. One of the groups, Center for Democracy and Technology, put out their objections to it, saying that it may make militarization of the federal government's cybersecurity program. It may permit companies to share internet information. It might preempt privacy laws. And at one point, apparently, Facebook actually supported this law. Google has been also quite quiet about it.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know what that means, but people are taking, at least people on a more liberal side, are delighted that the White House is actually might very well veto that bill.
Yeah, good.
There's also something I'm sure you know about and have been probably talking about, but Senators Leahy and Sanders are going to try and give seniors and taxpayers better deals in negotiating drug prices. This is a bill that they are putting forth. So far, it's basically a Democratic bill.
So far, it sounds like it's just a Vermont bill.
It's called the Medicare Drug Savings Act. As you know, at this point, you can't negotiate for drug prices under Medicare. It's kind of crazy.
Well, it's not kind of crazy. It's a poison pill that was put in by Republicans to destroy Medicare.
Right.
Let's call it what it was, you know, what it still is. So this is just Leahy and Sanders so far. These are the two senators from Vermont.
But there's a lot. Rockefeller, Nelson of Florida, Klobuchar, Tammy Baldwin, all of those folks are very, very involved in this.
Great.
And
this would save. I mean, my understanding is that if Medicare could negotiate drug prices the same way that the Veterans Administration does, or the same way that the health insurance companies do, the same way that Walmart does, that it would save $600 billion over the next decade.
Right. Well, it looks like, I mean, it's unclear whether this is for the decade or whatever, but they do, at least it is scored, in other words, as saving $141 billion, but we don't know whether that's just for, a few years or what.
Yeah, well, my numbers may be, in fact, my numbers are a few years old. I memorized that number several years ago, so it may be wrong now.
Right.
So
that is that's what they're trying to do now. Watch that absolutely go nowhere.
Because the Republicans will filibuster.
Right.
Because,
now, also, by the way, there was a person of interest, as you know, supposedly a Saudi national. He went to the hospital, got treated. His apartment information was taken from his apartment, but he's no longer a person of interest. And it's not quite 5 o'clock on the East Coast, but the Federal Aviation Administration holding all American Airlines flights at the original airports because there was a glitch in their software. So on top of everything else, the Sabre reservation system was not working. And therefore, they stopped all the airplanes.
Do they think that somebody might have hacked the software or something? Is that what you're
suggesting? They won't say, but hey, I mean, it's not been a good couple of days.
It's not. Sabre's a pretty damn robust system. Louise and I used to own a travel agency, as you know, and we had Sabre. We use Sabre. I'm very familiar with that automation system, or at least the way it was from 83 to 86.
Right.
And, I mean, they were one of the real pioneers for Sabre to go down. That's a big deal.
Right. So that is a big deal. Also today, National Journal actually reported that this chain CPI could not only hit all retirees, but middle-class retirees are people who are even getting tougher because people who are over 76 are not going to be hit by it. But other ones are.
Amazing. Ellen Radner, thank you so much, Ellen.
Thank you.
GoatsForTheOldGoat.com.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, Tom. What? We're okay? Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, every now and then the equipment hiccups on you. We've had several reports from Boston about, you know, what's been going on. We talked to the photojournalist. We talked to the professor of journalism who was there yesterday. Anastasia Chukina is with us. Anastasia is an international correspondent with RTTV, the Russian television network, RT.com, the website. Which our program, the program that I do, the Big Picture, we license to RT. Anastasia, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Tom. Good to be with you.
Are you the Anastasia who came out to Portland years ago?
Absolutely, yes.
Oh, it's great to hear.
My colleagues, Barack Obama was about to be elected when we interviewed with you the first time.
I remember it well. It's great to hear your voice again.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're working out of New York then, which is why I haven't seen you around so much. I'm curious. You're in Boston. You're on the ground.
Correct.
What's going on there? What's the sense? What's the latest?
Oh, Tom, you know, really still kind of a palpable atmosphere of confusion remains here in the very heart of Boston where we are right now. You know, many people still are really in disbelief about the tragedy that occurred here. Of course, you know, it was a major holiday for the state of Massachusetts, and this kind of chaos and drama unraveled, and people are still trying to figure out how to move on. And the area where the blast, of course, took place, that entire several blocks are cordoned off. Police is investigating the case, as we know, and we are hearing on the news, and the officials tell us is still very fluid, still so many questions, really no tangible results that we're hearing on the ground as of yet, except, of course, for the numbers of casualties. Those remain to be at least three people. Unfortunately, those include an 8-year-old boy and a 29-year-old young lady, and over 175 people injured, and 17 of whom are still in critical conditions as we speak.
Yeah, remarkable. Anastasia, you report for an international network. You're on the air in over 100 countries. You are colleagues with people who are doing international reporting. I'm curious. I'm assuming that you're hearing some feedback, you know, from the rest of the world, and that you're getting questions from people in other countries. And if that assumption is correct, what sort of questions are being asked, and how is the rest of the world viewing what's going on in Boston right now?
Well, you know, obviously people from all over the world treat something like this, no matter where it happens, as a tragedy, and we're definitely getting a lot of feedback from people saying, you know, they're just shocked to hear about this kind of news. And, of course, considering the recent school shooting that took place in Newtown, you know, it's really something that whenever you hear about it, you don't expect, and certainly people are concerned. But the questions that we're hearing are, you know, what will happen in the United States next? What will this mean for future policies in the United States? You know, right now, we know, of course, that Barack Obama is saying that it's still not clear whether this was a domestic or a foreign terror act, whether it involves an individual or a group of people. But regardless of the outcome, people are already asking themselves whether or not this is going to end up affecting both foreign and domestic policies in the United States. Because, of course, as we know, whenever an attack of this kind of caliber happens, or smaller or larger, that always leads to steps being implemented by the U.S. government. And people are, of course, wondering, both Americans and people abroad, whether that's something that's going to happen in this particular case as well, as more results continue coming in.
Will the national security state, the security industrial complex, I don't even think it's a question of will it grow. It's how much will it grow as a consequence of this.
Right.
And the will question is, I'm laying out opinion, not news here, but, you know, when 9/11 happened, George Bush had a choice. He could have treated it as a crime, and, the way that, for example, the murder of Aldo Moro was by the Red Brigades in Italy back in the 80s, and or the Baader-Meinhof gang in Germany, or the IRA for that matter. And it could have treated it as a crime, gotten Interpol involved, tracked down the bad guys, put them in jail, and that's the end of that. Or he could basically declare war on the world and turn the United States into a lockdown camp and create prison camps and create horrors. And today this report came out with Asa Hutchinson, a Republican, saying, yes, we committed torture. The United States went, in my opinion, insane. At least the Bush-Cheney administration did. And so it sounds to me like, tell me if I'm decoding correctly what you're saying, the rest of the world is waiting to see, is Barack Obama going to go down the George Bush go insane route, or is he going to respond to this in a more measured and rational fashion as the leaders of typically advanced democracies do?
Tom, you know, that's a very valid question, of course. I mean, I think it's important to answer this. We have to remember that right now, in these first 2 days, we're seeing the Obama administration being extremely careful with their wording when it comes to this tragedy. And that's very important because they're trying to not make any kind of rash conclusions and say anything until they're 200% certain in terms of what happened. But I think it's a legitimate concern that if we have to underscore if this, it does turn out to be an incident involving potentially a foreign kind of influence, then certainly the concern is big that this could mean You know, you say the war on the world. That's, you know, a very, I would say premature in this particular case term to use, but it really depends on what kind of results the investigation comes out with.
Right.
And you can see anything happen. I mean, I think, depending on what they say and who's behind this, I'm sure it's going to be a pretty serious crackdown if it is discovered that this is somebody from abroad. If this is somebody from, the United States, that's a completely different story. And obviously, I think it will depend on the results, what kind of steps exactly the administration will take.
Yeah. And the Bush administration had, you know, fairly clearly in the, John Yoo, Jay Bybee memos and some of the other statements that came out of the Bush White House, and that we learned later, had, identified literally the entire world as the battlefield post 9/11. And or asserted the authority to behave anywhere in the world as if it was a battlefield, and that this was going to be war without end. Now, Obama walked that back a lot when he became president. He stopped using the phrase war on terror. He didn't use the word terrorism in his initial public presentation yesterday, and it was like the wrath of God came down on him looking at these right-wing websites and news sites and the right-wing talk radio guys and the right-wing talkers over at the right-wing television. Oh my God, he's not using the word terrorist. What is he, a wimp? You know, that concerns me. Was that nuance picked up by the international press?
Definitely, Tom. You're right. Obama definitely didn't use the word terrorism on Monday, but of course today that has already turned into a terror act. They're talking
right.
about a terror act. He's using this term, and you know, when bombs are being used on civilians, that is a terror act, regardless of who's behind it.
Sure.
So certainly this is something that's changed, and that's certainly something that's being picked up internationally, because the terminology went from being a criminal case yesterday throughout the day to a terror act, and you know, the White House definitely coming out and using the stronger language.
It'll be particularly interesting if this is, you know, like Eric Rudolph, the guy who bombed the Olympics back in Atlanta back in the 90s. If it turns out to be a homegrown terrorist, are we going to start referring to Americans as terrorists? We typically have avoided this, you know, to avoid offending the sensibilities, I think, of some on the very, very hard right.
Right. Well, you know, obviously, if this is discovered to be a homegrown terrorist behind this act, of course, it seems that the public outcry among Americans would be possibly just as strong as if this were an international scenario, which I think many people are expecting it to turn out to be. But, you know, I think it's important that we keep in mind that regardless of people being kind of a little bit, I would say probably more shocked if it's a homegrown person, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
With all the, you know, policies that have been put in place over the last years, with the, you know, the NDAA, the Patriot Act, and so forth, I mean, in many senses, the way Americans are being treated and surveyed in this country,
we're already there.
I don't think many people who are aware of these things.
Anastasia, we have to wrap it up. Thank you, Anastasia Cherkina. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Good talking to you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more. What's going on in Boston, and there's a whole lot of other stuff going on in the world as well, right after this. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. And Jeff in Sherman Oaks, California, listening on Sirius. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Tom, you've always been a mentor to me, and recently I've added Joe Madison. You know, I've been a lone voice for the Fairness Doctrine since 1989. I've called radio all through the 90s and everything. It's never happened before that the previous caller took the words right out of my mouth. But I have to add to it, I think the American airwaves are part of the American commons, and I agree with everything you and she just said. But I remember arguing with you 1 to 2 years ago, where you took the opposite point of view, and Stephanie Miller and Randy Rhodes and Ed Schultz and Chris Matthews, none of these so-called liberals have ever been for the Fairness Doctrine. In fact, they argue against it. Stephanie Miller went to Congress and testified that the people of America do not need a Fairness Doctrine. And I'm amazed to see, and I learned from you, that you changed your mind, and I'm just wondering if I have, because I told you, that, you know, I would rather people listen to you than Rush Limbaugh, but you just want to be another Rush Limbaugh, another version of him, if you're not in favor of the fairness doctrine, because Rush Limbaugh...
Well, let me, Jeff, if I may, please. First of all, I have no idea what the positions of all these other people are with regard to the fairness doctrine. Secondly, the position that I was taking years ago, and am still to this day, is that I am not in favor of the fairness doctrine as characterized by Limbaugh, by conservatives, and by Republican politicians. They are all asserting, and falsely, it was not true, but they all asserted that what the fairness doctrine meant was that if a radio station carried an hour of Rush Limbaugh, it had to carry an hour of me. If it had, this kind of thing, that there had to be so-called balance. And I don't, first of all, who's going to determine what the balance is? And who's, you know, Rusty Humphries is not quite as hard right as Rush Limbaugh. So should Rusty get an hour and a half and Limbaugh, or maybe Limbaugh gets 40 minutes? You know, I just think that's insane. I don't see any way to enforce that. And yet, that is how most Americans understand the fairness doctrine to be and think that it worked. It never was that way. It never worked that way. Repeatedly, because the Republicans are constantly talking about the fairness doctrine, I had to come on the program and say, I am opposed to the fairness doctrine as these guys are characterizing it. Now, what the fairness doctrine did say, and up until it was taken out of law, was that the public airwaves are the property of we the people. A bunch of this was blown up by Clinton in the Telecommunications Act of 1996. But that the public airwaves are the property of we the people, and arguably so are the cable rights of way that cable systems operate through. And because of that, there must be some giving back. In other words, it's partly the commons. And so a radio station, television station, cable system, whatever, and cable actually still does this. They do it by funding C-SPAN. But the radio and television, what they had to do every year was they had to demonstrate when they got their license renewed that they were programming in the public interest. And that typically had nothing to do with right or left programming. In fact, the biggest talk radio, in America, I mean, first you had Father Coughlin, and then it kind of went away for a while. And then you had Alan Berg. He was a left winger. And he was, you know, blowing out this huge signal over 34 states out of Denver. And then he was assassinated. And then Limbaugh came along. None of this had anything to do with the Fairness Doctrine. What the Fairness Doctrine said was you have to broadcast in the public interest. And what that was interpreted to mean was occasionally put on a PSA, hey, there's a bake sale on Thursday. But mostly, at the top of every hour, you have to have real news. And as a consequence of that, radio stations lost money on their news operations. And I know because I worked in the business. And from 1971, 72, whatever the year was, until 1978, I was doing news in the biggest station in Lansing, Michigan. And we were absolutely not allowed to be talking to the salespeople. It was an absolute firewall. There were five people doing news in one station. I'll bet there's not one person doing news in that station. I'll bet they're carrying network news. And all the networks lost money on their programming. And I remember when Reagan stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine in 87. In 88, when CBS proudly announced that they were moving their news division under the umbrella of their entertainment division, and they were going to start making money with it instead of losing money, and everybody started closing their foreign bureaus because they no longer had to provide a good, high-quality information content so that stations could say, see, we carry this news, therefore we're programming in the public interest. End of my rant, Jeff. Have I made myself clear?
Yes, but because of Roger Ailes, who worked in Reagan administration, the Fairness Doctrine was repealed, and that opened the door for Roger Ailes and Fox News and Rush Limbaugh to come walking through the door. But misinformation and disinformation...
No, I think they would have come along with or without the Fairness Doctrine. It's just that what would have happened is that because if the Fairness Doctrine had stood in place, I don't know about Fox News, because with cable, it's a kind of a different
Roger
animal.
Ailes.
But
Roger Ailes.
If the Fairness Doctrine had stayed in place, the news at the top of the hour would have had to actually be news instead of infotainment and fluff, and the nonsense and distortions and hysteria of the day that the right wingers constantly put out on programs like Limbaugh's would be debunked simply by the presence of the news itself. And that's what went away.
That's my point. Misinformation and disinformation is a huge problem that we all face today.
I agree.
People don't know what the truth is anymore.
I agree.
Because
Okay.
I agree. Limbaugh, but I'm saying the solution is not to muzzle Limbaugh or, for that matter, to muzzle me. This is opinion radio. It's to make it's to bring back news.
No, but he won't be able to compete if his lies are pointed out, and so-called liberals on the radio ought to be speaking the truth and fighting for a fairness doctrine. I think you just started the dialogue to bring it back.
I have been talking about the fairness doctrine in these terms for a long, long time, and when President Clinton took it off the books, I spoke out on this program, sadly. And Jeff, thank you for the call, and thanks for letting me vent and clarify my position on this. The problem is that if you were to ask 100 Americans on the street what is the fairness doctrine, 98 of them would tell you that it means an hour of Hartman equals an hour of Limbaugh, which it has nothing to do with. That's the problem.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
The problem is that the right-wingers didn't want you to know news, and so they created a straw man, and they promoted it so hard that most people believe the straw man, not the actual law. The good, the bad, and the very, very bathycalypianly ugly. The good. The West Virginia State Legislature. At the end of last week, West Virginia joined the ranks of 11 other states in calling for a constitutional amendment overturning the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision. That decision overturned important provisions of the 2000 McCain-Feingold Act and has unleashed a new era of unfettered corporate electoral spending. The text of West Virginia's Senate Resolution 24, quote, supports an amendment to the United States Constitution to establish that corporations and unions are not entitled to the same rights and protections as natural persons under the Constitution, end quote, and urges West Virginia's congressional delegation to take action on Capitol Hill to pass a similar measure. Good work, West Virginia. And if you're interested in joining the fight against corporate personhood, check out movetoamend.org. The bad. Congressman Steve King. Monday's Boston Marathon bombings put the national debate on immigration on pause, but Steve King, representative for Iowa's 4th Congressional District, decided to use the tragedy to offer his perspective on our current visa program. He said, quote, some of the speculation that has come out is that, yes, it was a foreign national, and speculating here that it was potentially a person on a student visa. He told the National Review, if that's the case, then we need to take a look at the big picture. If we can't background check people that are coming from Saudi Arabia, how do we think we're going to background check the 11 or 20 million people who are here from who knows where? End quote. There you have it. There's currently no suspect in the Boston bombings, but Representative King is already blaming the attack on Arabs and calling for restrictive immigration policies. Never let a tragedy go to waste, right, Congressman? And the very, very ugly Eric Rush. And now for more post-marathon ugliness. In the immediate aftermath of yesterday's bombings, rumors swirled about a Saudi national held in a Boston-area hospital as a, quote, person of interest, end quote. Although those rumors turned out to be false, they riled up conservative commentator and Fox News contributor Eric Rush enough that, like Iowa Representative Steve King, he called for more restrictive visa screenings. In a Twitter exchange, another user asked Rush if his comments meant that he was already blaming Muslims for the attacks, to which Rush replied, yes, they're evil, let's kill them all. That's unacceptable and very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. I find myself saying that a lot. I think we get an awful lot of these. Anyway. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, thanks for listening to KBCS. What's up?
Hey, Tom, before I comment on what I was going to say about Rusty Humphrey's remarks, the two reasons, or two of the reasons that the slippery slope is a argumentative fallacy is, number one, it presumes that as rational thinking human beings that we are not able to discriminate, which is discrimination being one of the definitions of intelligence.
In other words, we're not able to determine this is an appropriate stop point.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Examples being, if we were to allow marriage equality, next thing people will be wanting to marry their goat.
The argument that I hear all the time, you know, if you want to raise the minimum wage to $10, why not raise it to $300 and then everybody will be rich and that's the end of poverty.
I was going to say, with marrying your goat, the goat cannot give consent, and two consenting adults can do. That if you wanted reduce a 100-round clip to 10, so you're reducing by 90%. The next thing, you'll reduce the 10-round clip to 1, meaning we don't know the difference between 1 and 100.
Right.
Because the percentages would be the same after all. Recognizing.
No, that makes perfect sense to me. I understand your point.
The second reason being that the status quo as it is now is what's keeping the world held together. If we got rid of that, the world would fall apart. When the status quo is not been what it is for eternity. So those are the two reasons that I learned in an argumentation course given by Dr. David Zareski at Northwestern University.
That the slippery slope concept is a logical fallacy in and of itself.
It's an argumentative, yeah.
Argumentative fallacy.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for that.
About Rusty Humphreys, he uses this amorphic term, and not just him, I don't get to address him. Yeah. The right wing uses this, the conservative, this politically correct, which is this amorphic, amoebic, meaningless phrase. But to him, it means, the victimization ideal, or something about victimization. And, let me compare just how I see him versus how he sees me and so on. Well, he says, his father was an alcoholic and he lost his wife and he doesn't feel like a victim. Well, you know what? I lost my eyesight to a genetic disease and I lost my wife too to breast cancer. Those aren't I don't feel like a victim for either one of those things, but I have experienced employment discrimination as a disabled person. Okay, and I guess I don't like being called handicapped because the etymology of that word means that implies that I'm a beggar. And my losing my wife to breast cancer was, I don't feel like a victim. But what did make me upset was that when she was diagnosed, she got her insurance company cut her off, her policy.
Yeah.
Okay, those are the things that, okay, so I guess that, and the other thing is, the way I see it, the right wing is that anytime you want to do something or address an issue, like 20 kids and their teachers get murdered in a school, well, now you're politicizing the issue.
Right.
So addressing an issue is politicizing it. And then if you want to do anything about it, well, now you're taking people's rights away.
Right.
You see, if you actually do something about it, like, oh, you'll be going down the slippery slope if you reduce assault weapons from a 100-round clip to 10.
Right.
Okay? And so this is the way I see him. Versus the way he sees me. I'm not a victim.
Yeah.
But that's the way he wants to cast me, so I see him as...
Here's the tragedy, and I was referring to this earlier when I referred to silos, and the fact that we had a caller who asked Rusty about ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and I know Rusty well enough to know when I'm seeing a blank look on somebody's face. He genuinely didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And, which kind of blew my mind. But... I think that increasingly in America, largely as a consequence of our ability to select our media, we are creating silos where we are unaware of the reality of others.
Correct.
And because of the depth of our unawareness, or because of the height of the wall created by the unawareness, our ability to empathize with the others is diminished. And our ability to mutually work for solutions is diminished. And I think that's a bad thing.
Well, and to summarize, yes. If I'm not willing to, if me or anybody else, if I'm not willing to accept the, and I'll use his phrase, the society created by the short, fat, rich, white guy, then I'm being a politically correct victim. And I'm supposed to accept this impotent point of view that you can't fix anything. Because if you address it, you're politicizing it, and if you do anything about it, you're taking people's rights away.
Yeah, well, and that is the we're really kind of talking about two things here. One is the siloization of America, and the other is this jingoistic perspective that is promoted by the Frank Luntzes of the world and the billionaires who fund them, which basically says, you know, their favorite phrase is "get over it," right? Which basically says if somebody is a victim, and I will use that word, a victim of discrimination, a victim of disaster, a victim of disease, whatever.
A shooting,
that, yeah.
Yeah,
whatever it may be, that there should not be any remedy unless some billionaire can make a buck off it.
Right, and wait till they find out how we can protect ourselves from this kind of bombing. When they find out exactly what the details are, the next thing it'll be is like, oh, you're politicizing it, and you, if you're not going to let people walk around with backpacks with pressure cookers inside of it, you're taking away people's rights. Because
right.
After all,
well, but see, the flip side will be every police department in this country is going to want to have five drones in the air at all times.
Well, okay, yeah, that's there is, but then there's no slippery slope because after all, we are intelligent human beings and we can discriminate. What kind
you
of
would think so, Paul, until you look at the damn Pentagon budget and the $2 trillion they can't find.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we wrote a constitution, didn't we?
We so, 240 years ago.
We're not as good at writers anymore.
Yeah. Okay, Paul, I got to move along. I always appreciate your very thoughtful calls, and thanks for helping me understand the it's a terrible metaphor, slippery slope, to begin with, the logical fallacy argument of it. Why? Thank you so much. James in Vero Beach, Florida. Hey, James, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Well, we're talking about the bombings in Boston and gun control and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a society, we have a paradigm here where recorded history pretty much, we've bred mental illness. We bred, and then we don't intercede responsibly at all when we do that. And then people act crazy, pick up a gun or whatever they can, and attack other people, and we want to blame the weapon? It's just unreasonable. It's like blaming the drugs for the war on drugs. It's insanity.
So your point is we should do what?
Oh, I'm not saying distinctly. We need to protect a generation of children, of course. But beyond that and how to do that, I couldn't tell you. But, I mean, we're mentally ill. We breed it, certainly in America, probably more than anywhere else in the world. And
well, you know, I've been in some pretty spooky countries, I'll tell you. There are some places where it's a whole lot less safe and comfortable to live than here. But you can find a clear correlation between the easy availability of guns and gun violence, in particular suicide. And that gives me pause. I do think that the weapon is a piece of the equation, James, respectfully. Thanks for the call. We'll be back. 45 minutes past it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
866-97-THOM. We'll be right back with more here on the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back, 10 minutes before the hour. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you and Mark in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi, how you doing?
I'm great.
Hey, you know that I worked in newspaper circulation for a while, and Reagan actually ended the subsidies for newspaper mailing.
Really?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I thought they were still in law. I thought the post office still in fact, I'm sure they, because when Louise and I moved out to Oregon, which was, 6 years ago. This was long after Reagan was gone. I wanted to know what, because I was going to be doing local radio in Portland, and I never lived on the West Coast before for more than, you know, the summer of 68. So I ordered the Oregonian, the newspaper, to be delivered to my home in Vermont every day, you know, 5-7 days a week. And it came at that special fourth-class newspaper rate, and it was cheap, cheap, cheap.
Well, maybe I don't know. Maybe the publication picks up the cost, but you know I don't know. See, I didn't do that job myself. I stopped working there in 2004.
Uh-huh.
And but the people.
Maybe Reagan dialed it back or something, or made it more restrictive or something. It had to be out of state or put some kind of qualification on it.
Well, the old timers who did that job, who actually did the mailing, they called them the mailers. They said that they said Reagan ended that, and when that happened. That drastically reduced the amount of papers they mailed. You know,
right.
Like a minuscule amount by comparison now.
Right. So. I'll bet there must be some kind of restriction on it that I fell into a category that made it possible because, you know, the normal subscription to the newspaper, to the Oregon newspaper, if you lived in Oregon, was like, you know, 25, 30 bucks a week or a month or whatever it was. And what I was paying to get it in Vermont was maybe 25% more than that or 30. It's been a lot of years. I don't remember exactly, but it wasn't so much more that it would have come even close to justifying the cost of sticking that thing in a box and sending it to me. And the other thing was that sometimes I'd get a paper every day, and sometimes 2 or 3 days would go by, I get no paper, and then all of a sudden I get 2 or 3 of them. So it was clearly a lower priority.
Well, that's, you know, that happens when I get the Nation magazine delivered, you know, so that happens too sometimes.
Yeah.
But anyway, I wanted to say one thing that, you know, if money is speech, right, then...
It's not.
Then, you know, then,
it's property.
Then everybody has an equal right to it, right? So then the government has to provide everybody with the same amount of it. So that would, by that logic, that mandates publicly funded elections. You know what I mean? It's like,
well, that's...
Could, you know, in other words, you could, like, if you call money speech,
right?
Then that could be just as compelling an argument for public funding of elections. You
right.
know what I mean? Because that means everybody has an equal right to it.
Right. That's an interesting logical train. And, you know, I was on the TV show a couple of weeks ago. I had some right winger going off on how money is speech. And so, you know, I pulled a couple of bills out of my pocket and, you know, like a puppet, you know, in your hand and said, okay, here's my money. What is it saying? And they were like, well, I don't know. What is it going to say? Well, if it's speech, it's got to be saying something. What is it saying? Well, I don't know. It'll say whatever you want it to say. Then it's not speech. It's me using property to propagate speech. And there's a difference.
Right. Capitalism means everybody is equal before the law. Rich and poor are equal before the law. Otherwise, you're still in feudalism, see?
Well, that's not what capitalism means. Capitalism means you can make your living with capital. You can make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive. Most people think that America is capitalist and Americans are Rusty and I were having this conversation at dinner last night. He's like, I'm a capitalist. I said, really? You make your money sitting around waiting for a check to arrive? He's like, no, I do a radio show. I work really hard. I said, you're not a capitalist. You're an employee. He said, but I own my own show just like you do. And I said, then you're an entrepreneur, but you're not a capitalist. I don't make any money. You know, maybe I make $100 or $200 a year on dividends from stock that I've bought over the years. Probably half of it from that 2 shares of Marriott stock, that stock that I bought back in 1975 when they were offering this 10% discount to stockholders if you stayed in their hotel. And now it's split so many times, it's worth thousands. You know, it's like $30 worth of stock. But it's like, I'm not a capitalist. And I don't, you know, I'll bet that I would be surprised if there are, you know, 10, 20,000 capitalists in the United States. People who actually make their living with capital.
Well, you know, what a word means is what people think it means. You know?
Well, yeah, there is that. There is that. And that's now we're back to talking about the Fairness Doctrine. You're absolutely right. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Carol in St. Paul, Minnesota, listening on Minnesota's Progressive Voice AM 950. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Oh, one quick is you've got to start correcting people like Rusty when they say Democrat when it should be Democratic.
I know. I know. Yes, you're right. I need to do it more.
It's painful.
You know, I did. Louise and I had dinner with Bob Ney the other night, who's a good guy who has, you know, who's like now spends most of his time hanging out with the Dalai Lama. He used to be a Republican congressman, and I'm sure he wouldn't mind my telling this story out of school. And he kept saying Democrat Party, you know, Democrat congressman. Finally, I said, Bob, there is no such thing. It's the Democrat. He says, you know, I keep trying to catch myself. You know, you're not the first person who's told me that. And he says, but it's a habit the Republicans have. It's like, yeah, I know. You're right.
And then one other quick thing.
Yeah.
I'm hearing false equivalency again about the liberals having radical people, too. And I'm sorry. I don't know.
Where did you hear that?
I'm a liberal. I heard it on a couple of radio shows this morning, not yours.
Yeah, you won't hear it on this show.
I want to know the last time a liberal blew another person up.
It was SDS. It was 1970, 71 maybe. And, you know, what's her name? I think it was Linda Evans. And I think that Bill Clinton pardoned her.
I think it was Patty Hearst.
Well, that wouldn't have been the last time because she was before that.
Okay. All right. So, I mean, I've heard it about this. Well, you know, there are liberal radicals. No, the radicals in this world are all conservative, no matter if they're Muslim or if they're American.
You know, I'd say there's liberal radicals, whether there are violent liberal radicals, I would disagree with. Although some of the black bloc folks who are smashing windows during Occupy things, I find that very troubling. but I don't think that that's the same thing as killing abortion doctors or whatever. Carol, thank you for the call, and thanks for listening to AM 950 in Minneapolis. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have the latest on what's going on in Boston as we learn more. Plus, Mike Papantonio, host of Ring of Fire, is going to drop by about Wall Street's ticking time bomb. Here we go again with that one. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active, occupy some.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.